The EU's executive arm is being forced to backtrack after Commissioner Oliver Varhelyi tweeted on Monday that all funding to Palestine is being cut off.
The announcement which was made by Commissioner Varhelyi was not preceded by consultations with any member of the college.
Regarding Israel's latest blatant flouting of international law, there's no sign that the EU will take any action. It has never done so in the past. We have already seen pro-Palestinian rallies take place around the world since Saturday. Now groups here in Belgium have announced they will hold similar events in the coming days. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The people of Pakistan have attended a massive rally in the capital city of Islamabad to voice their anger against the atrocities committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories. They expressed their solidarity with the Palestinian people and called for an end to Israel's occupation of their land.
We demand from international communities that they should take action towards this inhumanity and they should do something, put action towards this. Like, they are suffering for 70 years. The Palestinians suffering from 70 years, on the daily basis.
We're here to stand in support of the activities happening in Palestine by Hamas against the illegal Israeli occupation.
The demonstrators also slammed the United States for supporting Israel, saying the so-called champion of human rights is providing financial and military assistance to Israel for killing innocent men, women and children in Palestine.
As America has announced the one-sided support of Israel, all Muslim Ummah, especially OIC, called its meeting and announced the support of the Palestinian fighters because they are under atrocities of the Israel. And all the Muslim Ummah has to support Palestinians.
The protesters urge the Muslim world to unite and put an end to attacks on Palestinians.
The firm stance of Pakistan is on Palestine's freedom and refusal to recognize Israel as a legitimate state reflects their commitment to the principles of justice, human rights, and international laws. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
Sailing towards what they hope will be the last leg of an arduous journey to safety. But those who make it face a hostile environment, thanks to the British government's controversial plan to deport thousands of asylum seekers coming to the UK illegally to the East African country of Rwanda. The plan has a short but checkered history. In June, the UK's Court of Appeal overturned a High Court ruling which had said Rwanda was a safe third country for migrants to be sent to. This week, the British government is appealing that ruling here.
Critics say the Rwanda policy pursued by the Interior Ministry risks violating the UK's international obligations to protect human rights. They're raising concerns about the impact of the policy on victims of modern slavery and trafficking, and also on women, children, and disabled people arriving on British shores.
There are concerns about people being prematurely returned to the nations from which they are fleeing in the first instance when an initial decision may be made. Is there a robust and independent appeal process for those people that would offer them protection whilst their claims are going through the independent tribunal service? There are lots of concerns about this ill-thought-out policy.
But the British Interior Minister Soila Braverman disagrees. Earlier this month, she dialed up her anti-immigration rhetoric in a desperate attempt to appeal to the Conservative Party faithful at their annual conference in Manchester.
The wind of change that carried my own parents across the globe in the 20th century was a mere gust compared to the hurricane that is coming.
Previously, she'd called the migrant arrivals an invasion, language that has led many to ask if her Home Office treats all migrants equally.
the UK take in far less refugees than any other country. And actually, if we look at the way that people from Ukraine fleeing for their lives have been treated, they were treated humanely. They were treated like human beings. They were welcomed and they were given safe passage.
It is all now in the hands of the Supreme Court judges. If they agree with the Court of Appeal, then the British Home Secretary's dream of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda in its current form is dead. Said Puriza, London.
Nigerian demonstrators who are waving Palestinian flags marched through the streets of Abuja chanting support for the people of Palestine and condemning the Israeli attacks on Gaza, where hundreds of innocent civilians have so far been killed. They expressed support for the Hamas Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, which was carried out in response to the Israeli violent attacks on Al-Aqsa. The protesters condemned the Israeli violent response against the people of Gaza.
Every right-thinking person in this world must feel bad over this daylight genocide in the eyes of the whole world.
The demonstrators said human beings are either brothers in religion or in humanity, and so support for the Palestinians becomes a duty for all Muslims, Christians, and followers of other religions.
The demonstrators here said they want Nigerians to break the deafening silence and condemn the murder of innocent Palestinians.
They also asked Nigerians to pray for the Palestinians.
People, and we all should be.
In an interview, the Palestinian ambassador to Nigeria condemned the massacre in Gaza and debunked the erroneous myth spread by the Jews as being a chosen people. He condemned the inherent racism of the Israelis.
Jewish supremacy, this is something that we are facing in Palestine in a daily basis. They are treating us today. They are declaring that they are fighting against a human animal. Could you imagine that? He did not mention that they are fighting against Palestine, a human animal. They considering us as a human animal.
The protesters burned the flag of Israel and America to signify the strong condemnation of their oppression and double standards. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
With our blood and with our lives, we support you, O Al-Aqsa. This was the chant that rang high in the streets of the Yemeni capital, where tens of thousands of Yemenis came out to express solidarity for the latest Palestinian offensive against Israel.
Today, Sana'a came out to say we are with Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, which will wash away all the oppressors and all of those normalizing ties and selling out Palestine. Today, Sana'a is letting the Palestinians know that we are with you and that this operation will lead to the end of all oppressors worldwide.
Ansar Allah officials at the rally congratulated what they called an unprecedented Palestinian attack that exposed just how weak the Israeli regime is. Muhammad Ali Al-Houthi, a prominent Ansarullah official, believes power is the only initiative Israel will respect.
The only initiative respected by the illegal occupiers is the kind of power that was demonstrated by the great fighters from the Palestinian resistance groups. Their heroic and iconic actions will be recorded in the books of history and will never be forgotten by the enemy and will never be forgotten by the Muslim world.
It is an Islamic obligation to stand with the Palestinians and to stand against our enemies and to stand against America and Israel. The conflict for us is a matter of central and fundamental Islamic duties. By the will of Allah, victory is near.
The demonstration also condemned some of the Arab regimes who have normalized ties with Israel, declaring those who engage in such political efforts as traitors to Islam Following the surprise offensive against Israel, senior Hamas military commander has called on all Islamic resistance movements in the region, including Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movement, to unite efforts to liberate Palestine today, not tomorrow. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The 5th International and 13th National Iranian Biotechnology Congress has kicked off in the capital, Tehran. The inauguration ceremony of this scientific event was held at the International Conference Center of Shahid Beheshti University. The Congress is the most important gathering of Iranian biotechnology specialists and will run until October 10th.
This conference is aimed at recognizing scientific and technological achievements in the fields of genetic engineering and biotechnology. Hundreds of scientists, researchers, and even students have participated in this event. Nearly 600 articles were presented to the conference.
The Congress aims to provide an innovative and comprehensive overview of the latest developments in different fields of biotechnology, such as pharmaceuticals and nanotechnology.
Regarding the Congress, we have been working so hard to organize a conference on mostly scientific and in entrepreneurship. What I can say about the Iranian biotechnology is that the progress has been immense in the past 20 years. We have had a few laws in Iranian parliament that supporting the startups and the high technologies, including the biotechnology, especially in medicine, pharmaceuticals. Iranian progress has been immense. We are exporting our pharmaceuticals to many countries, but the progress has not been limited on pharmaceuticals, on kits, on several different aspects.
Biotech products account for nearly one-tenth of Iranian knowledge-based companies' income, as well as 60% of their exports. Currently, about 800 knowledge-based firms are operating in the field of biotechnology in Iran. They have managed to fulfill the country's domestic needs by manufacturing homegrown products and decrease the country's foreign exchange spending.
We are a knowledge-based company that has managed to produce thermocycler machines in Iran for the first time. This machine is used in the quantification of DNA and RNA. This apparatus is used in many Iranian laboratories. It can compete with the foreign models as it is very accurate and has a reasonable price.
We are a knowledge-based company active in the field of diagnostic and extraction kits production. We cooperate with many Iranian companies, labs, and research institutions. In the long term, we want to export our products to the neighboring countries.
Around 30 types of biotech medicines are produced in Iran in addition to kits, vaccines, and blood products. Also, 80% of biotechnology pharmaceutical items are domestically produced.
Iran is an advanced and developed country in biotechnology. It's ranked first in the West Asia and 12th in the world. And by supporting knowledge-based companies and academics, the country seeks to improve its global position in this field. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Hundreds of people have taken to the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad to express their support for Palestinian people and to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities against Palestinians. Chanting slogans against the US and Israel, the demonstrators called on the Western nations to stop supporting the Tel Aviv regime and respect the rights of Palestinians.
West has shown their hypocrisy, their dual standards. They again stood up for Israelis. They raised their voice like America and other countries that what has been done by Hamas, that was a brutality. But what has taken place in right now in residential area of Gaza, they are not raising the voice of the Gazans. They are not raising the voice of innocent Palestinians, where many dozens of innocent children and women are killed.
The demonstrators also urged the Muslim world to unite in order to put an end to attacks on Muslims living in Palestine.
All of the governments of the world except Iran and some other governments like Syria and Iraq, all of the other governments are like, they're acting as puppet of the U.S. And that's very painful. And obviously, the nation, the people, the Muslim Ummah is standing behind Palestine.
This is the time for the Muslim world to voice its solidarity with Palestinian brothers. We, the Pakistanis, express our support for the Palestinians and call for an immediate end to Israeli violence and oppression.
The Pakistani government has expressed its deep concerns over escalating tensions in the West Asia and expressed its support for Palestinians, calling on Israel to immediately halt its oppression.
Supporters of the Palestinian cause often express a deep commitment to continue their unwavering and unconditional support for the Palestinian liberation movement. They emphasize that the struggle for self-determination and justice for the Palestinian people is central to their advocacy. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Heads of governments were focusing on bringing more countries into the EU during a summit in Spain on Friday. However, millions of citizens across the current 27 member states are being neglected. A debate in the European Parliament has heard.
There are now 900,000 homeless people on any given night in Europe. And it's estimated that up to 125 million people in Europe live in energy poverty.
Apparently, social welfare systems in the EU are broken.
People across Europe are struggling to pay their rents, their mortgages, even the energy to heat their houses. Those losing their jobs are at a serious risk of becoming immediately homeless.
Sanctions against Russia are hurting the EU's economy. This as huge sums are spent on the war in Ukraine. Unlike EU decision makers, it seems a growing number of citizens want peace talks.
The solution is there. The solution is not to rearm Europe.
If France or Belgium had the war and Ukraine had this huge money, are we thinking that they're gonna give us this money? I don't believe so.
Meanwhile, the cash keeps flowing out of the EU and into Ukraine. Since things escalated in February last year, the EU has spent 83 billion euro on arming Ukraine, propping up the government in Kiev, and housing Ukrainian refugees. Some legislators claim it's a war the EU simply cannot afford or win. The European Central Bank has now increased interest rates 10 times in a row. The strategy, aimed at reducing inflation, is being questioned.
Inflation is the enemy of the poor and those on low incomes, but equally, high interest rates causes recessions, and recessions bring about unemployment.
Analysts point out that those driving the EU's economic and foreign policies are well able to afford the consequences, unlike the average person. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
The UK may block Assange's attendance at appeal to European Court of Human Rights. UK officials deny the case is about press freedom and they won't say anything about whether Assange can go to France. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, should he be deported from the UK, Julian Assange, the Australian publisher of WikiLeaks, faces up to 175 years in a U.S. prison on charges related to his release of information that revealed U.S. war crimes and torture. His legal team has stated that they plan to appeal the extradition case to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, arguing that the British litigation process has been rife with malpractice. However, experts say there is little likelihood that Assange, who is currently being detained without British charges at London's Belmarsh prison pending extradition, will be allowed to physically attend any ECHR hearings in Strasbourg, which lies in France's Alsace region. The UK authorities' case against Bale has always been that he is a significant flight risk and a reminder of his 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy. Tim Dawson of the International Federation of Journalists, a group opposing Assange detention, told Truthout. He added, "I can see that they are going to allow anything similar to arise." One reason the British Home Office could be nervous about letting Assange attend hearings is that this flight could come in the form of an embarrassing asylum bid once Assange reaches French soil, a bid that would have significant credibility behind it, given that the United States government officials have already broken the publisher's attorney-client privilege and actively considered killing their would-be defendant. And given that the British legal process has included documented conflicts of interest. A British Home Office spokesperson declined to comment on whether Assange would be allowed to attend ECHR hearings, emphasizing that any appeal to the ECHR is still theoretical for now. Assange's legal team tried last year to appeal preemptively to the ECHR, but was told at the time that the British appeals process needed to be exhausted first. According to Kevin Gosla, who wrote a book on the case, he says that timeline worries Assange lawyers. A fear among the Assange legal team is that the British High Court of Justice may issue a final decision on the extradition and then the authorities could whisk him away to an airplane. He could be in transit to the US before his attorneys are notified of the outcome of the appeal and can appeal to the ECHR. Among other revelations, WikiLeaks has published video showing the killing of two Reuters journalists by U.S. military personnel, along with documents describing torture of detainees at U.S. military facilities in Iraq. While those revelations may seem somewhat historical at this point, other releases from WikiLeaks remain essential to recent news. This summer has been the 7 hottest days on record during a month that is poised to go down on the hottest in recorded history. According to WikiLeaks releases from 2016, the U.S. privately pressured Germany into dropping its demand for a 25 to 45% midterm carbon dioxide reduction in 2008, a move that almost certainly had an impact on the current climate emergency. While Assange is often described by colleagues as a difficult person to get along with and one increasingly prone to erratic behavior, his case could set a significant and dangerous precedent if his extradition is allowed to go through, free speech advocates from across the political spectrum argue. That's partially because of what's called the New York Times problem. Essentially, they worry that if the door to prosecution of journalists for dealing with secret but civically important information were to be spanned and opened by this case, it could never be shut, with future governments not hesitating to prosecute reporters for outlets like the New York Times if they published embarrassing stories. Similarly, problematic for Assange supporters, including many in the media who have also criticized him, is the assertion of universal jurisdiction by the United States. Goslar told Pointer in April, the effect of the U.S. or any other country claiming universal jurisdiction for prosecutions means that investigative journalism, particularly efforts to uncover crimes and abuses of power committed by military or security agencies, is endangered. Noting that other national governments could see an extradition as a green light to pursue their own draconian clampdowns on free speech in the name of national security. On the topic of national security, U.S. voices critical of Assange have often been outspoken, citing the idea that secret sources and operatives working for Americans in hostile territory have been put in danger by his publishing of the leaks. Asked to name a single person killed or injured by WikiLeaks publications, however, State Department spokesperson declined to comment, referring throughout to a Justice Department spokesperson. The Justice Department spokesperson then declined to comment on the matter. If the U.S.-British allies attempt to prevent an ECHR appeal by shipping Assange immediately to the United States, after a British judgment, it would not be the first time an attempt has been made to do an end run around the Strasbourg court, according to reporting by Italian outlet Il Fatto Quotidiano, which found via Freedom of Information Act request that Swedish and British officials had tried to preempt a theoretical ECHR appeal in a Swedish investigation of potential misconduct by Assange that was later closed. The Home Office spokesperson told Truthout that this case is not about freedom of expression or a free press, which the UK unequivocally supports. Goslar says that simply not true, stating that the UK government does not unequivocally support freedom of expression or a free press. At a time when people in the UK are suffering due to record-breaking heat from climate change, the UK government has targeted environmental protesters with Public Order Act 2023. This bill was appropriately condemned by United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, who condemned the deeply troubling legislation. Goslar cites the Index on Censorship, which assessed UK freedom of information and activism, and found that the country had dropped into the third tier globally in 2023. He wrote, "Many of the groups that pressured the UK government to successfully alter a national security bill to diminish its impacts on journalists are the same groups that say the extradition case against Julian Assange is absolutely about freedom of expression." He added, the UK government cannot have it both ways.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio.
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The mainstream Western media has once again staged a propaganda campaign against Iran, this time following an incident for a 16-year-old Iranian female student at a Tehran subway station. Armita Garavan collapsed in a metro station on Sunday, October the 1st. The anti-Iran media outlets were quick to blame the Iranian security forces for the incident, but credible testimonies and published videos, including the CCTV footage, suggests otherwise.
16-year-old Armita Geravand fainted while boarding a train at a subway station in the Iranian capital. Immediately afterwards, anti-Iran TV channels and outlets embarked on a media campaign blaming the incident on the subway police. They accused the police of pushing Armita out of the train after a noisy argument leading to her fall. Now the Tehran subway company has released old camera footage from the moment Armita enters the station till she is taken to hospital. Here is 6:52 a.m. October 1st. Armita enters the station alone. After 2 minutes, she passes the ticket control gate. At 6:54, she enters a grocery store in the station, and after that she is seen here heading to the platform, where she catches up with her friends. It can be seen that the whole 8 minutes of her presence in the station passes without a problem. Armita and her friends wait to board the train, but they don't take the first one. It seems they are waiting for a friend. Armita's arrival on the platform and her boarding take more than 8 minutes. Still no scene or any problem. And Armita and her friends board the train, but after just 4 seconds, she gets dizzy and falls down. After Armita's fall, people on the scene call the emergency services and try to revive her. A couple of minutes into the incident, medical teams arrive and she's transported to the nearest hospital. Armita's close friends say there was no quarrel and it was simply a normal day to school.
Her head hit the ground. I tried to pull her to safety with the help of others. When my hand touched her head, there was blood. We brought her out. Let me say this. Nothing happened on the train. No one pushed her. No one quarreled with her. Nothing. The moment she got on the train, she just fell.
Armita is now in hospital, and according to her medical report, she has gone through low blood pressure. Armita's parents say they have not seen any irregularities in the camera footage provided by the subway company or her medical report. They have called for people to pray for their daughter's health.
I've seen the subway footage, and I don't think what some people say is true. I've seen all the footage and followed it closely. Nothing was wrong.
Last year, similar media tactics employed by the anti-Iran news outlets incited violence throughout the country. Yet the misinformation campaign has only failed.
Well, joining us in our studios here in Tehran, our correspondent Gisli Misha Ahmadi, who had visited the medical center where Armita is hospitalized, is here to give us more details. Gisli, it's great to have you with us. What details can you share with us and our viewers?
Well, before I tell you about the experience I had today going to the hospital to find out more about Armita Bardia, first I'd like to clarify that for anyone living in Iran and in Tehran, it is absolutely absurd to hear that there was some kind of police or whatever, security officer or whatever, to confront someone for particularly the way they are dressed inside the metro station. This is something that has never happened ever in the history of Iran's metro, particularly because there are special wagons for women, and women are usually free to dress the way they want to inside those wagons. So, you know, this particular detail is really disturbing for anyone who lives in Tehran and who uses the metro, which I happen to be one of those people, and I use the metro very often. So putting that aside, I had the opportunity to go to the hospital today, and I was allowed to go all the way upstairs to the intensive care unit where Armita is actually there. I was able to talk to her father. Her mother and her sister just left for the city of Mashhad, the holy city of Mashhad, where Imam Reza's holy shrine is located. It is traditional for Iranians, whenever they have any problems, they usually go there to pray and ask Imam Reza to help them and bless them and, of course, grant them their wishes. Obviously, Armita's family are under a lot of pressure right now. And what makes the ordeal even tougher, Bardia, is the fact that they have to deal with all of these media reports and, of course, reporters who are calling them from here and there, trying to figure out what's happening. So on the one hand, they're already under a lot of pressure because of their daughter, who is now in intensive care unit. And like I said, the mother is away with the sister in the holy city of Mashhad to pray for her to get well soon. And on the other hand, they have all of this commotion coming from anti-Iran media outlets who have been once again able to create a story out of thin air. And for anyone who watches the CCTV footage, it is quite obvious that nothing happened and it was just an accident, and whatever it was, it had to do with Armita's health herself. She was not pushed, she was not confronted by anyone. She was accompanied by her friends on her way to school, as she would do every day. And of course, I will be talking to the medical staff tomorrow, and I will be giving you more details about that tomorrow, where they will be explaining exactly what happened to her.
All right, thanks a lot. Isu Mishahmedi joining us in our studios here in Tehran. Also joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Also joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, human rights lawyer and peace activist Daniel Koval.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Brussels. Sir, how do you view this recent incident, which has led to many Western-backed media outlets to start their anti-Iran narratives? What's the reason for such a rush to demonize Iranian security forces in the first place?
Thank you for having me. It is obvious that Iran is under the microscope, and on the first occasion, on the first small incident, you have immediately the mainstream media jumping on it and just transforming it, quoting. And that's not journalism, really. quoting a Kurdish source in Norway, an activist in Norway, reporting about what's happening in the metro in Tehran, when there are the footage of CCTV showing a man coming in the wagon just a few seconds before, after the Armita went in, and then just staying by the door to see how the girlfriend came out. So there is no manipulation of the video. But on the other hand, we understand that it took them a year in the mainstream media and those manipulators to find something that they can blame Iran and try to reproduce exactly the same story or similar to the story that came out a year ago of Mahsa Amini, and to accuse Iran of violating human rights, etc., and all these excuses that normally here in the West we love to accuse Iran of, or any other country that is not submitted to the Western hegemony. So, I mean, I'm surprised it took a year to regain all the aggressive campaign against Iran, and that has been going on since 1979 in different forms. But because the West has mastered the art of manipulation of the media and the footage and the use of the social media and mainstream media to take advantage of it, so it shows how they are really waiting by the second, by the minute, by the hour to grab the first opportunity that can inspire them to create a story out of it. And honestly, it's always the same reason. Iran is not submitted to the West, and Iran is demonized for the last 43 years and will continue to be so. So I'm not surprised if we see another story coming up in the next month, depending what they find, really.
Daniel Kovalik, what do you make of this recent episode of anti-Iran propaganda? And in addition to that, can you tell us who benefits in general from such anti-Iran campaigns? What are the motives behind these campaigns?
Well, first of all, my reaction is, you know, I live in the United States. The police in the United States kill over 1,000 people a year. We have incredibly violent streets. In New York City, it's not, you know, uncommon that someone will be, you know, pushed by someone into the subway and killed. The point is, I don't want to sound insensitive, but I have to respond. I don't get it. Like, that people would be calling for action against Iran for this is incredible. Again, given what you could find in the U.S. on any daily basis, that is 100 times worse than this. Now, who does this benefit? Obviously, it benefits people in the State Department who want to overthrow the Iranian government. The U.S. has wanted to overthrow the Iranian government since 1979. It successfully overthrew the Iranian government in 1953 and installed the Shah, and then it's been upset ever since 1979 when the Shah was ousted in a popular revolution. So there's many in Washington that would like to find reasons to cause public unrest in Iran. Obviously, there are people within Iran and Iranians outside Iran who would like to engage in regime change. You have the MEK, for example, that's been involved in regime change activities for a long time, so they might benefit from this. But again, these are the old-fashioned techniques used by, in particular, the U.S. intelligence agencies like the CIA to try to foment regime change. Like, actually, they used similar tactics against Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. So it's not surprising, but again, this incident seems hardly the type of incident you could latch on to create regime change. But I don't know. I've been surprised by other things. So.
Elijah Magnea, the United States and its allies, they constantly demonize Iran. The continuation of these hostile and provocative policies against Iran are believed to be trying to stoke Iranophobia and promoting a propaganda campaign against the Islamic Republic. Where does this hostility from Washington towards Iran stem from? Is it because of maybe Israel's interests, or is it the fact that Iran is an independent country in the region and that really irritates the U.S.?
Well, it all starts from the Iranian constitution, where it is clearly cited that Iran supports all the oppressed people around the world, and the Iranian cause is, never forget, the central cause, that is the Palestinian cause and their right of return to their homeland and recover their occupied territory. By saying, by taking out these 2 points, Iran becomes the enemy, because Iran is the enemy of the Israelis who occupy the Palestinian land. And Iran is supporting all those who want to fight against the U.S. And its allies, imperialism in the Middle East and anywhere else. Iran has supported the Palestinian, the Lebanese Hezbollah in Syria, Iraq, in Venezuela, and Iran, part of the Shanghai Cooperation, will also be part of the BRICS in January. So all this activity and Iranian wealth in natural resources increases the appetite of the West to attack Iran, demonize it, and bring it to submission, particularly when Iran is refusing that. And its model is giving also an example to other countries like China, Russia, Latin America, Africa, who wants to stand against the U.S. hegemony. And Iran has been doing that for the last 43 years and still surviving. And that pushed Iran to depend on its own in almost a lot of things and a lot of needs, and particularly in the military aspect. So because of that, Iran will always be demonized. Iran will always be attacked. The Iranian progress in the nuclear program, in a peaceful nuclear program, is creating even more havoc in the West. How Iran can reach such a level of scientific knowledge and advanced in technology, advanced in weaponry, and having more than 3,500 sanctions on it for the last decades. So all that is really putting the West in a position where other countries can follow the same model or can find other alternative to rely on other allies rather than the U.S. and its allies. Because of that, and because of Iran is really putting obstacles in front of the American plans and planning in the Middle East, and in particularly in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq. Because of that, it is costing the Americans a lot to try and keep their position and not to look like a fool or incompetent or not strong as they want to look like. And on top of that, Iran is the only country just after the Second World War that dared to bomb the U.S. in Ain al-Assad military base in Anbar in Iraq following the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Because of that, it's enough excuses to demonize Iran all the time.
Daniel Kovalev, let's talk a little bit about the media hypocrisy. Media outlets, social media networks, which often caution against jumping the gun on spreading news too soon, or without decisive evidence, they seem to act the opposite when it comes to Iran. Why is that?
No, I think that's right. Iran is guilty till proven innocent. And again, because there is this demonization that's been happening with Iran. And again, since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has just been portrayed incessantly and relentlessly in the U.S. press as some sort of insane dictatorial nation, when in fact, you know, in the region, it's frankly one of the more enlightened countries. I've been there, you know, I was there in 2017, was very impressed by it, by the culture, by the intellectual milieu of the country. But that's not what you learn about in the United States. It's been vilified. The leaders have been vilified. And so they're very quick to blame Iran for anything. And again, that's also because they're parroting the views that are being pushed by Washington in their effort to overthrow the government. You know, and sometimes it's successful, these types of vilification campaigns. I mean, what comes to mind is Libya. You know, since I was a child, Muammar Gaddafi was portrayed as this crazy man, this mad dog. I think that's what Reagan referred to him, that needed to be overthrown. And he ultimately was, you know, and look at what that country is now. It's been torn asunder. It's now three separate countries, essentially, now, and slaves are being sold on the streets. And I guess if the U.S. had its way, that's what would happen with Iran. And, you know, so it's very dangerous, this type of vilification campaign that the press is engaged in.
Sure. Elijah Magnus, same question to you. Talking about this hypocrisy in the media, this demonization, it's been proven through and through against Iran. Press TV, our very own channel, has paid the price for challenging the global media dominance of Western news outlets as the U.S. seized the website domain of Press TV. In the past, we've faced growing restrictions on our platforms. We were removed from broadcasting satellites. What's your reaction here?
Well, if we take the example of Press TV, we take the example of Julian Assange, anyone who's writing about the truth is no longer accepted. We've seen that in the war in Syria and how the mainstream media reacted unprofessionally. And we thought that journalism has some values and some respect to the profession to be really taking the news and the truth as it is and to give it to the reader. Unfortunately, this is continuing throughout the years. We've seen also how they covered the war in Iraq, they covered the war in Libya, they covered the war in Syria, and they're covering the Palestinian saga and cause. So all that is a double standard. Doesn't come only from the media. It comes from the European leaders and Western leaders who have double standard and who have a very high level of hypocrisy in any matter they are dealing with. So they turn things to their advantage. Things that are accepted for one country, they're not accepted for another country. So there is no more professionalism in our profession. Today, anyone can write anything, quote any source, like in case of Armita quoting someone in a human activist in Norway, a Kurdish human activist in Norway, but we don't have their name, we don't know how he can testify and be testimony. So even Reuters quoting only two sources, unnamed sources. So everybody jumped on the story in a very unprofessional way. And that is something that we've been suffering from for the last years. And it's not something new, really. It's going to continue. Unfortunately, people are looking for alternative news and looking for social media, looking, trying to find the news between the lines and spending an awful long time to look for the truth. Well, unfortunately, okay. Not many people have the time to do so.
All right, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, Mr.